Welcome to the Save or Die Podcast, a podcast about classical Dungeons & Dragons. If it's in a box, we'll talk about it.
Okay, folks, we're back. This is episode, or now we're going to be entitled on Adventure Number 2. As you've already been to our site and listened to Adventure Number 1, we also put up an interview with Tim Kask. A nice long interview. If you want to go and download that and comment on that, I would appreciate it. As you already know, I'm DM Vincent. In the background there, as you can probably not hear because they're not saying a single word, is DM Mike and DM Liz. Mike, how's it going?
I can't say because I'm not saying a single word.
Ooh. And Liz?
Things are going pretty well.
Smurfy well?
Smurfy well. It's a very Smurfy day. I had a Smurfy math test earlier today, and now things are just incredibly Smurfy.
Excellent.
Okay, I can only take a certain amount of the Smurfiness. I'm just warning everybody right out the gate.
Yeah, probably so. So what we want to do is give our email address, and that is Mike. What's our email address?
Save or Die Podcast at gmail.com. Where we have received nothing yet.
Ooh.
It's because nobody likes us.
No, that's
everybody
not
hates us.
No, we've gotten some nice feedback here and there. So
we have. We have on a lot of the threads. So far, everybody seems to like it or, you know, on the whole, like it and just offer constructive criticism, which is nice. I mean, everybody can improve.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I think the most problem was they were talking about pacing, but that's just something that comes along with experience in podcasting and getting your flow together with the whole group. So
exactly. You're the only veteran among us.
Yeah, that's true. With all the podcasts that I've done. Anyway, save or, yeah. Save or Dive. Save or Dive. Wow, that's a new podcast name. Save or Dive. Save or Die Podcast. And the saveordie.info is our website. Take a look at it and see what you think, and then we'll head over to what do we have in the news this week? Oh yeah, Mike, you wanted to call out for some news in the classical community,
right? We want to start covering any of the information that is involved with the classic Dungeons and Dragons community. Like, for instance, Encounter issue number 2 is out. That is a free fanzine by Jesse Walker, which basically covers just about the same things we do as far as the classic D&D community. I've read it. Pretty good. I certainly enjoyed it. Got some adventure things I fully intend to steal for my campaign. Mm-hmm. But we need more. So please, drop an email. Come over to our forums, which are off the website. Drop an email. Send a carrier pigeon. Send them on trained attack snails. Whatever. Just let us know these things, because we want to try to communicate it more to everybody who's interested.
Well, there's only, like, what? There's the one magazine out there right now?
Yeah. I had heard rumors that Oddities was supposed to be coming back, but I hadn't heard anything since then, so I don't know if it's back or not.
Is that the magazine you just... was that? That's not put out by Troll Lord Games, is it?
No, that's Crusader Magazine. Oddities was started, back in 02, 03, and had about 18-issue run, I think. 14, well, no, more like 14. Anyway, they're available for download over dragonsfoot.org. And it was called Oddities for O-D-N-D, mm-hmm. You know, being its main focus. And it was great while it lasted, but unfortunately, the main guy behind it, whose name escapes me at the moment, Richard something. Anyway, he had some personal, you know, as usual, real life rears its ugly head, and he had to go, you know, deal with other things, and so the issue went by the wayside. I'd heard it was going to come back as a for-pay magazine, but haven't heard anything since.
Aren't you also part of a OD&D, mailing list?
Yeah, online? Yahoo group called the OD&D Guild. Check them out at Yahoo. It's got nifty, good could use more traffic, but whenever there is traffic, it's always very interesting topics. Like,
definitely.
Yeah.
No, go ahead, Mike. I was going to say something else, but go on with that.
There's also, you know, Knox Spell Magazine, which is published by Black Blade Publishing, and it's for the Swords and Wizardry retro clone, which pretty much works with any classic D&D.
That's going to be on the local shelves pretty soon, as I read.
Yeah, I think they were going into actual distribution.
Is Matt Finch still involved with that, or did he give that up to Black Blade Publishing?
From what I understand, Black Blade's got the license pretty much to do it and the Swords and Sorcery core, basically the hardback. Brave Halfling Publishing is doing the Swords and Wizardry white box set, which is, you know, kind of like the old original D&D with the digest-sized books and everything.
Hmm. Well, we saw several of the back issues of Knox Spell while we were at North Texas RPG back in June, and it's a very nice-looking publication. I think it would certainly do very well on shelves at gaming stores.
And if you prefer the electronic version, you can get them, the PDFs, $5 a piece, which is what I did. I got the first three issues and read them, and they're pretty cool. I mean, definitely got an old dragon, the dragon feel to them.
Yes, the dragon feel and the dungeon. Yes. If you're interested in maybe writing or putting up some articles on our website, you can also contact us on the email address, and we'll talk about maybe if you want to write a featured article every once in a while. You know, you can't find a publisher and you just want to publish some stuff that your idea so people can read, we'll definitely give you a shot and put you up on the website. Just contact us at that saveordiepodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, as long as it's classic D&D in a box or their subsequent retro clones.
Sweet. Let's head over into DM Fiat.
Nope. Sorry.
What?
Nope, you're wrong. Look it up.
I don't have to look it up. It's common knowledge.
Nope.
No.
So DM Fiat this week, and it's also a new segment to our listeners out there. It will be pretty much discussing some rules, any rule or any thing pretty much that comes out of one of the boxes that people usually debate about and go, yeah, I'm right about it, something like that, in one of those voices. The topic of
it's called DM Fiat because, again, in the end, it's what the DM says goes.
And it's a very Gary word.
Quite. Like milieu or Dwilmer.
Definitely. And this week we'll be talking about spells in general.
Yes.
So, first topic of debate, so we can get people screaming at us, why is there no cantrips?
Well, cantrips, I suppose, really showed up in Unearthed Arcana for AD&D, but they're just so darn useful.
They are.
I mean, they're the little things that may not affect, you know, a grand adventure one way or the other, but, you know, they're the little things you expect to see wizards doing. You know, in literary sources, you know, there's the magic user waves his hand and the, you know, drink becomes either boiling hot or ice cold or, you know, just little nothings that you would expect a magic user to do, but in
light
D&D,
his pipe with a finger, you know,
finger
burning
flame.
The tip.
Yeah, little mundane hand gesture things that, you know, don't really take much thought that you would see in, like, movies or reading books and...
Right. Which is why, since there aren't any, I've had to come up with a list. I might even put them on the site if we can.
Yeah.
Of cantrips for my basic expert game. Because certain people, who shall not be named, loves playing magic users, and she likes cantrips.
I have no idea what you're referring to.
We have no idea either. So why wouldn't they put them in there? Do they feel that they were not necessary, or they just didn't feel it was the realistic feel, or maybe they were not going for a realistic feel? What do you think?
Well, I would think... Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in first.
Go ahead.
I would think with the roots of the game, you know, having their, you know, basically started out as an extension of miniatures wargaming, there really wasn't a place for anything like cantrips in that kind of game, because, like you say, they're not going to affect the outcome of any kind of a combat usually, unless you're very creative with them. I think it wasn't until Dungeons & Dragons had been around for a while and it was going more into the role-play aspect as opposed to the miniatures warfare aspect that people even really started to think about, well, how about spells that are not necessarily useful for fighting, but just something to flesh out the magic user character, you know,
yeah,
the things that they do to impress the unwashed masses in the small towns and things like that.
But that, I don't know. It's kind of like, why would a magic user want to waste his time lighting a fire by wasting a spell per day? It could be a cantrip for that. He wouldn't have to waste his spell slot for the day.
Right. And, you know, who knows? Certain circumstances, a well-placed cantrip can save the day. One of the games I was running, they were the party were fighting this drow sorceress who was trying to get away, and she was reading a scroll to cast a passwall spell, and as she's reading it, the magic user of the party cast the bee cantrip and had it fly into her mouth, which caused her to cough and sputter, which of course ruined the spell.
Ooh, that's some nasty effects.
Yeah, it was just so out there that I said, you know, hell, that's, you get it, you know, I'm giving you this, because it's just such a creative use.
Wait, yeah, there's also, clean works really well.
Oh,
as a cantrip.
Yeah, the magic user with clean becomes everybody's best friend in an adventure.
And Oitugs hate the clean cantrip.
Oh, expand upon that a little bit more.
No, well, no, they live in...
what's...
Oh, well.
All right.
Just remember, they live in filth, and they don't like that filth being taken away.
Exactly.
Good way to defeat something.
Overclean them.
So, now, the next thing we have on our list here is, why are there no durations? Why are there no... Well, there's durations, sorry, but why are there no casting times or like segments like they have in later editions? They just, the spell goes boof and it's done. Did they not figure that some spells were going to take longer, or they really didn't care at that point?
Well, as far as Holmes, I suppose you could make the argument of, and to a lesser extent Moldbay, is, well, it's basic, you know, you don't want to get into that level of detail maybe, but yeah, to my knowledge, Expert and Companion didn't. I'm not that familiar with Master or Immortals, so... And besides, when you're immortal, I imagine casting time is the least of your worries.
Yeah, really.
So, yeah, I mean, unless it was specifically described in the, you know, actual paragraph at the end of, you know, after the range and duration, that, yeah, I mean, it pretty much goes off during the magic segment of combat.
And what do you think, Liz?
I would say it's probably due to it being basic. Not wanting to get into all of the math. It's like, okay, well, I'm starting my spell on segment 3, but now I have to count and see, okay, the spell isn't going to go off until segment 8. It would be my opinion that they just left it out to make it a little bit easier for first-time players.
And I believe segments only showed up in first edition.
True,
but I don't think they were in original.
Wouldn't you think, being going from miniatures, like they played the chainmail, that every little movement like that would count? Because you only get a certain amount of things. I've never really actually played the original chainmail. I played the newer edition of chainmail that the Evil Company had made in the early 2000s.
Yeah, the re-release.
The re-release of it. And I remember just about everything you did had a certain amount of impact on what you can do per turn. So yeah. I would think casting a spell, there'd be a certain amount of impact on a segment or how long it would last. Or, not how long it lasts, how long it would take to do it.
Yeah. Of course, conversely, the idea of lightning bolts bouncing and fireballs, you know, in a limited area of effect, I believe were not introduced until advanced either. So, you know, I all I could think of is they just figured it wasn't worth it, you know, as far as slowing down play.
So how did you guys explain things such as, like, magic missile? Did you explain magic missile in your games as an imaginary missile cops out and just hits? Or did you say it was this imaginary little ball that was on top of the wizard's head following him around, like in the old games, shooting out things? Or was it like a dart he threw and it turned into a missile? What would you guys do for that?
Liz?
I always imagined it as a bolt of energy coming out of the caster's hand when the spell was cast. I don't believe that it would have been basically empowering an actual missile, a physical weapon, with the magic aura. I just always thought of it as like a little energy dart or an energy bolt that got flung from the caster's hand.
Okay.
Yeah. That's kind of where I came from, too. I remember hearing recently the idea about it just kind of glowing over the magic user's head, and then just, you know, whenever released, it just goes off to do its job of blowing up. I never thought of doing that way. That does sound kind of cool, but...
Yeah, I think that was from one of the video games way back in the 80s. They did that with the magic user, but... I've always pictured it as the magic user taking something like, I don't know, say like a component like a rock or maybe a dart, throwing it in the air and boof, it turns into the magic missile. But you know, it doesn't actually say that in the thing, but I've always imagined him doing something like that.
Well, again, that's the beauty of the vagarity of the, you know, basic rules is, you know, they just give you the base effects. How it looks is really up to you.
Products of your imagination.
Though, rereading just a little while ago, I was reminded that actually in Holmes, magic missiles were not automatic hits.
No.
You had to roll them. But they were in Moldbay and subsequent.
Well, I think Tim went over that in the interview with us that originally it was that way and he was responsible for changing it to what we know now, right? I believe he said that.
Yeah. Something like that. But anyway, it and yet if Holmes was supposed to be the introduction to AD&D, you know, it seems kind of weird.
All right, well, if anybody knows some history on that or wants to speak up, you know our email address, you know our website. Go to it. Use it. And we'll head into random encounters.
Random encounters.
All right, random encounters this week. What do we have? And this week, you better be right, Liz.
Kobolds!
Yes, you're right.
Ah, finally.
Finally? We had one episode. What do you mean, finally?
Yeah.
It just seems like forever.
Aw.
She really likes kobolds.
All right, since you really like the kobolds, why don't you tell us your basic description of a kobold?
Ah. Well, it depends on what you're reading.
As we know, there's various different statistics for a kobold. Most of them are the same, but there's some slight differences, and we'll go over that in a few moments. But Liz, continue.
Well, based off of the pictures on the... And I probably shouldn't even be mentioning this because it's the AD&D Monster Manual, and we're supposed to be talking about basic classic D&D. But they always looked like little dogs to me. And I got into I wouldn't exactly call it an argument, but a laughing disagreement with Mike when at one point he mentioned that we were attacked by a group of kobolds, and I stated in the middle of the game, puppies!
They're not because puppies.
They look like puppies. That picture on page 58 of the Monster Manual totally backs me up. There's this one just sort of cowering behind a little wooden shield, and it just looks so cute.
Well, yeah.
Or as cute as a kobold can look.
I've noticed that kobolds have really changed their looks over the years, going from edition to edition. If you really look at it, they've gotten uglier and more disgusting looking.
Well, yeah. Holmes, basically, they're called dwarf-like. They're not mentioned looking like dogs at all. Evil dwarf-like creatures. And then when you get into subsequent descriptions, you know, evil dog-like men. And it just sort of goes... I suppose dog-like is maintained afterwards, but starting out with Holmes, they were just considered dwarf-like, and that's all the description you get of them.
Mm. Yeah, and original D&D didn't really have any descriptions of any detail as well.
Yeah, looking at all the different rules like Challenger and Holmes, it all pretty much say evil, well, we got that down, and they're dwarven-like, and mm-hmm. either that or dog-like. I haven't seen anything else wise. Humanoid.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Although, there is occasional mention of them having scales.
Yes.
Or hairless hides, at least.
So the big differences I'm looking at mostly was between the different rule sets was, what did I see here? Was, well, alignment went from just plain evil to lawful evil in the Holmes edition, obviously. And there was another thing I noticed about them that was pretty much different.
Oh, and they you mean chaotic?
Yes, chaotic, sorry. Yeah, they didn't use evil. My bad.
Yeah.
Everyone could write in and yell.
Well, was chaotic also... was evil as far as that was concerned.
What was the differences that you guys noticed?
Well, the movement range kind of went weird.
Yeah.
Because in Holmes, I believe they ran 120.
Yeah, they were really fast.
Which is pretty much normal to a normal human being, for example. But subsequent, it started getting smaller, you know, to one point they were only moving like 60. And then another, they're moved 90, 60, back to 90. It's, I don't know. Most everything else stayed the same.
The XP value?
Yeah, armor class.
Damage was pretty much either 1d4 or by weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah. Hmm.
Even the halfling, the kobold chieftains pretty much remain the same, basically, whether it's said fought as a gnoll or fights as a two-hit die creature, da-da-da.
They also get a +3 save on...
On magic.
In the Holmes?
Yeah, that was a difference, because that was in Holmes.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Holmes right now, and it said they get a +3 on all saving throws except for Dragon Breath. I mean, all... Yeah, magic saving throws, except for Dragon Breath. I was like, wow.
Yeah, and that's never mentioned again in any of the other types.
No.
Yeah.
Everything else
is just saves as normal man.
Oh, and by the way, they hate gnomes.
But don't we all, really?
Well, I know you do.
Gnomes are people, too.
No, they're not.
Okay. So how would you use it in your game, Mike?
Throw them at the PCs. No.
Not gnomes.
Oh, yeah, right. We're talking about kobolds.
Yes.
Well, to me, the kobolds, especially as a group, to me are the epitome of the monsters that would set traps and ambush. Specifically because, individually, they're rather weak. The idea of a group of kobolds, you know, just charging in and fighting, you know, six, say, PCs, six kobolds rushing in and fighting them toe-to-toe, no. No, they're smarter than that. They're going to set traps. They're going to try to ambush. You know, all sorts of things. I personally think it's all right for them to keep, say, I've had them keeping giant rats as pets or ferrets to, you know, basically attack intruders with. And they should have no problem with running away to fight another day.
Yeah, I've always liked using them as decoys, or having those stupid players that like chasing after the monster because they have to kill the monster because they have to get that experience points.
Have to kill every single one. Yeah.
You know that you always have that one fighter in the group that does that. So you have the kobold run, and hopefully he gets away with the fighters and kill him. And you have him run into, like, say, a cave or an open foresty area, and just have like 20 of them pop out on him.
Mm-hmm. So it's ambush.
A nice little ambush. They're not that stupid. I don't like when people play monsters stupid. So.
Yeah, that's almost as annoying as lawful good being treated as lawful stupid. But that's probably a whole other subject.
Yeah, it's with orcs and things. Why people have to just go, do they come up and they attack you? Why can't they be tactical? Why do they have to be stupid? I mean, they're...
Yeah.
You're the DM. You're playing them as if they were your character. Play them like it's your character.
Kind of like those martial arts movies where, you know, the main guy is fighting 20 of the minions of the main bad guy, but they only attack him one at a time. They just encircle him otherwise and then just attack one at a time very nicely.
That's called honor among fighter. I don't know.
But I'm sure that happens a lot.
Every Bruce Lee movie.
Oh, absolutely. Probably most of the Chuck Norris ones, too.
Hey, don't mess with Chuck. Anyway, Liz, what would you do?
Well, Holmes Basic, because they have the +3 to all magic saves, I'd put a whole bunch of them against a group that had a magic user, because Sleep Spell is not going to be nearly as effective. They may not be all, you know, affected by the spell.
But there's no save on Sleep Spell.
There is that. But generally, where there are saves, the kobolds aren't going to be as affected. And I'd throw a whole bunch of them at them. I mean, you can have up to 60 appear. You know, why only have 6 show up against a party? Have 20, have 30, especially if you're wandering around in the caves near where they live.
Definitely. And also, the kobolds don't have to just be like these little fighters with spears like everybody pictures them. They can also be maybe wielding magic. Why not? The chieftain. Oh, yeah.
Nothing annoys me more than, you know, monsters, especially somewhat intelligent monsters that have magic items in their treasure, but for some reason they never used it. You know, the players find it after they've killed the monster. Oh, they had a +3 sword. Boy, I'm lucky he didn't actually think to wield that against us.
They'd be too smart.
Yeah, I can't have that.
Yeah, another interesting idea might be, you know, these critters are tribal. You're not going to find them in a city.
Nope.
But what if they've lost their territory for some reason due to some earthquake or flood or ousted by a more powerful group of monsters? You could have the whole clan of them attempting to drive out human settlers from an area that they're trying to make into their new home. And PCs can be called upon to protect the settlement. And you're dealing with a whole bunch of kobolds rather than just a small group.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And
strength in numbers.
Yeah. We'll have to throw it out to the listening audience to see what they have to say, and they can email us with their thoughts and their opinions.
Well, and we'll maybe one last bit, if I can throw in.
No.
Let me just... Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
The last quick thing I wanted to mention is, also, kobolds are, you know, short creatures. There is no reason why their tunnels have to be human-sized.
That's true.
That can be an advantage all by itself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I never thought about that. Sure. Why would they have to bother digging out human-sized tunnels if they're really small little creatures? Yeah.
For the same reason you have air ducts large enough for people to crawl through in every single action movie or TV show.
Yep. and the villain going, "Since you're going to die anyway, let me tell you my plan."
Yeah. Here's the plan. I'm going to kill you slowly. Anyway, like I was saying, tell us what you do, tell us what you think. SaveOrDiePodcast@gmail.com.
These Dungeons and Dragons game, products of your imagination.
So we're in products of your imagination, and this one, this week, is going to be all Mike, all the time. Mike, tell us what you got.
Well, it's something I sort of mentioned with Tim Cass during the interview, is a book called The Dungeon Master, The Disappearance of Dallas James Egbert III by William Deere. Now, for those youngins in the audience, that is, anyone younger than 35, probably.
Hey.
In one of the things that really set off in the 1980s, the whole idea that Dungeons & Dragons was evil, satanic, people played it and went insane or thought they were their characters, da-da-da.
Oh, I know. Jack Chick.
Yeah. The Dark Dungeons cartoon with Jack Chick and all that stuff started, or at least got its mainstream media coverage, when a 16-year-old kid named James Dallas Egbert disappeared from college in Michigan, in East Lansing. And
I don't know.
He was 16 because he was one of these brilliant kids and went to college early.
Doogie Howser. He was a Doogie Howser of his time.
Basically. Though he was more into computers than medicine. Oh. But anyway, he disappeared.
Well,
Dungeons & Dragons was blamed on it. A private investigator from Dallas named William Deere was hired to come in and investigate and find out what happened to him. This is basically his point of view of how the case went, what was going on, etc. Now, I've heard a lot of bad things about this book. I had heard that, you know, Deere didn't know what he was talking about. He made D&Ders and gamers in general sound like demented psychopaths, etc., etc. And I must say, for the most part, I did not find that to be the case. He did mention about all the stories of, you know, supposedly playing D&D in the steam tunnels underneath the college. Supposedly a bulletin board that was found in Egbert's room that had pins and a weird pattern on there that they originally thought might be a dungeon or a secret message or something. Turned out it wasn't. It was just a board with some pins on it. But, and to Deere's credit, he admits that, even though he had thought that might be a clue. In the end, it wasn't, and he admits that.
So, but, Mike, how did they connect D&D to the suicide, or I should say the disappearance of this Egbert guy? Because it was in his room? They just assumed that that's what it was?
Well, he was a player. He was very big into Dungeons & Dragons.
Uh-huh.
His parents knew that. The kids around campus knew that. This was 1980. And
disco was dying.
What's that?
Disco was slowly dying at this point.
Yes. And it was the new college craze. Everybody was playing Dungeons & Dragons. So that's what he got him first to pay attention to it. The book reads kind of like almost a private investigator novel, and Deere is not shy about tooting his own horn. Talking about some of his adventures had been used for episodes of Magnum P.I. and Hardcastle and McCormick and other such, you know, sure. Anyway, without commenting on that, he has one chapter in the book set aside where he hired a kid from the college to bring his buddy over and to run him a game of Dungeons & Dragons because he wanted to see what it was like, maybe give him some insight on what happened to Egbert.
Okay.
And that chapter, I believe, was really fair. He did not talk down about gamers. He did not talk about how the game was drawing him into the bowels of El Diablo or anything like that. I thought it was rather fair. Turned out the kid was found. He was in New Orleans. He had basically ran away because college was giving him too much grief and had went to go hang out with some friends. That was, and of course, when he became this media sensation of missing, he didn't want to go back home because, well, that's kind of embarrassing. Deer's book tries to make it sound like it was some weird, you know, hostage thing he had been taken by someone in the gay community. But then I don't know if that's true or not. Tim Cass seems to think it's not, and, you know, he certainly lived through it, so. But just talking about it, it's a great book, I think, to show what the point of view was of the average citizen and the average American when Dungeons and Dragons first came out onto this, you know, into the American consciousness.
So how did TSR and Gary react to this book at the time? Did he put a statement out, do you remember? Or?
Well, in the book, Deer mentions that the people at TSR were very helpful. They gave him records for Gen Con and some other things, see if maybe Egbert had attended Gen Con after all, and if so, that could be a clue as to finding him. Gary told me that he and Tim Kask and some others had sat around with that supposed bulletin board with the weird pattern on it, trying, you know, going through all sorts of stuff, you know, some of their products, maps, trying to figure out what it was could possibly be. Deer doesn't mention that in the book, and I'm rather disappointed at him that he didn't, but anyway, the point is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't anything. But he does admit that they were very helpful and, you know,
okay,
were not bizarre people.
You do keep referring back to the pattern, so what was the pattern? Can you describe it, or was there a picture of it?
There's a picture in the book. The copy I had, it wasn't really legible, because it was an e-book, but it turned out that it wasn't anything. It was just, that was how Egbert had a bulletin board. That's just where the pens all were when he left. It really didn't mean anything.
Oh, so it's kind of like he just shoved them on there and was going to use them, but he just never had a chance to use them type deal.
Yeah, or, you know, he'd put a message on there, then he'd take it down, stick the pen to the side, you know, just, you know, it just be happened to be the way he was storing the pins on the board.
So it was a case of someone just overlooking into, just looking too much into something that was not there.
Right. And like the whole idea of his suicide or his running away, you know, there, oh, well, Dungeons and Dragons said it. No, it was over, pressure to succeed, to be, you know, a wunderkind, and dealing with the fact that he was gay and on drugs. But it had nothing to do with Dungeons and Dragons at all.
Just one of the many scapegoats at the time.
Yeah. Well, Liz, you read at least the chapter about when he was playing D&D with the two kids. What did you think?
Well, I thought that, you know, he came away with a fairly positive attitude about the game. You know, he was very careful to say when he first met, you know, not only the guy who was being the DM, but also the friend who was going to be a player along with him, you know, that they were, you know, very typical Midwest kids, good looking, might have been athletes. You know, he's very careful to point out that these are not weirdos of any kind whatsoever. You know, they're normal kids. And
I cast magic missile.
Anyway, he went through the game, through the process of creating the character, and at least by the way that he wrote the excerpt in the book, by the end of the game, he was pretty much getting into it himself and sounded rather disappointed that things ended where they did because he wanted to find out what would happen to his character next.
Interesting story. And you can pick this book up on Amazon very easily?
Oh, yeah.
All right. And what was the full name of the title of the book again?
The Dungeon Master, The Disappearance of James Dallas Egbert III by William Deer, D-E-A-R.
All right. Anybody who wants to go out there, just take a look at the Amazon reviews and pick up the book and read it, and then give us a shout back and contact Mike, and he'd like to hear your thoughts about the book. And that's going to bring us out into a nice, sad close again this week, folks.
Aww.
Yes, that's going to end our show of puppies and Smurfs and
Dungeon Masters.
And Dungeon Masters and little short gnomes to punt across the room.
All kinds of goodness.
That's right. As we leave you with adventure number two.
Electric Boogaloo.
No, we're not calling it Electric Boogaloo. We'll be signing off for this week, and we'll be back. Gen Con is this week. Depending on when the show goes up, could be before or after Gen Con. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit about Gen Con when we come back for adventure number three. I'll be going to Gen Con, and Mike can tell his past experiences about going to Gen Con.
And I can talk about... I was going to say, I can talk about how I've never, ever been to Gen Con.
That's awesome. You can talk about how you've never been to Gen Con.
I can too. I went to Origins.
Okay, cool. So, find us next week, saverdie.info or saverdiepodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us on the dragonsfoot.org forums or the Sword and Wizardry forums or our own forums. Give us a shout, say hello, say goodnight. We're leaving. Later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.